drool the goofy toothpaste on the cool boys' boulevard, you croupy young docilegs. Sig sheas, tara stock. It's the Blind By Podcast, yurt. God bless you all, you spring cunts. It's, the weather's improving. It's getting a little bit springy, isn't it? It's getting a small bit springy. There's the promise of dew in the air. The fucking... the smell of a leaf that hasn't happened yet. Do you know that one? The buds aren't out yet, but you can just smell. It's a resin. You just know it. There's life. There's the potential of life ready to happen. And I'm looking forward to those balmy evenings. So, this podcast is growing internationally at a bizarre rate. I've got a following in Buenos Aires, which I never thought I'd have. How are you getting on, Buenos Aires? So anyway, because the international following is growing, I'm getting a lot of offers for international podcast dates. So there is going to be a tour of Canada, right? In July, I'm coming to Canada, to Toronto and Vancouver. After this podcast went out last week, so I got approached by a company that was like, Blind By, we noticed you have a following in Canada. Will you come and do some podcast gigs for us? So I says, yes, I fucking will, because I love Toronto with all my heart. I've never been to Vancouver yet. Fuck me, I love Toronto. It's one of my favourite cities in the world. It's like, it looks like New York, but it has the heart and soul of London. Which basically means there's no Americans there. Sorry, America. I do enjoy a bit of Toronto, and I'm going to be going there for... First off, the company said to me, will you do some live podcasts? And I said, yes, I will. But can I bring with me my dear friends, Mr. Chrome and DJ Willy O'DJ, the other two lads who are part of the Rubber Bandits? And they said, yes. So in Canada, in July, there's going to be two Rubber Bandits gigs and two live Blind By podcasts. I announced them on Thursday. The Rubber Bandits gig in Vancouver is sold out already in the Rickshaw Theatre on the 4th of July. That's sold out. In Toronto, the Rubber Bandits show on the 6th of July, there's only like 50 tickets left. So if you want to come to see the Rubber Bandits in the 6th of July in the Opera House in Toronto, get your tickets now. The live Blind By podcast in Toronto and Vancouver, right? Those dates aren't on sale yet. I think they're going on sale on Friday the 6th of April, I think. But the podcast dates are Blind By podcast, the 3rd of July in the Rickshaw Vancouver, and the 7th of July in Toronto in the Opera House. So those are the live podcast dates that aren't on sale yet. One thing I did want to say, and I was a little bit concerned and confused, right? So I've got a load of fucking listeners in Canada who are like Canadian people who don't know fuck all about the Rubber Bandits. They just know this podcast. And that Vancouver Rubber Bandits date is after selling out quickly. So just to say to any Canadians, I hope some like 60-year-old Canadian person who listens to this podcast didn't accidentally buy a ticket to a Rubber Bandits gig. It's a very different flavour. Just to the Canadians listening, the Rubber Bandits gigs will be a very sweaty, loud affair with mostly just a load of fucking Irish people living in Toronto or Vancouver coming to our gig to get to get shit-faced and take loads of drugs and have a mad rave, and it'll be very loud and sweaty and chaotic. You're more than welcome to come to that, Canadians. You are fucking more than welcome. It's going to be great crack. I think it's actually a legal hash company that's bringing us over. I need to check that out, but I'm nearly sure. My agent said to me it's like a legal cannabis company that's taking us over. But it's going to be nuts. The Rubber Bandits gigs are going to be... We're kind of on a break from doing live gigs. We haven't done a live Rubber Bandits gig in Ireland for a while. But when I rang up Chrome and Willie and said, man, we go to Canada. Man, we go to Canada and have a fucking laugh and hang out and have a bit of crack. Of course they said yes. So, just a heads up, Canadians absolutely come along to the Rubber Bandits gig, but know what you're getting. You're getting a very sweaty, loud, drunken affair, which will be great crack, but an incredibly different flavour and atmosphere to the live podcast. The live podcast is going to be me with a guest. I don't even fucking know who I'm going to be interviewing. I can't wait to ask ye to suggest some guests for me in Toronto and Vancouver. Live podcast is going to be a guest. It'll be mostly Canadian people, I'm guessing. I don't think anyone's going to be shit-faced drunk at the live podcast. I hope not. Most likely not. So that's the kind of chilled out vibe. Me in a conversation, live podcast. But then the fucking Rubber Bandits gigs are just going to be a very loud, a collective spiritual vomit from the island of Éireann. That will be the crack. And I hope it's not too fucking hot. I don't know what, like, I suppose Canada does get a bit hot, doesn't it? I was in New York once with MTV around fucking June or July, and it was fair hot, you know. We went out to Jersey Shore. So I hope Canada's not too hot. We'll deal with it. Fuck it. We'll turn on the air conditioning. It'll be grand. I hope I get time to chill out in Toronto. I really do. My schedule is going to be insane. Lots of gigs, lots of travelling, lots of kind of business obligations while I'm over there. The Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto is the greatest museum I've ever been to in my life. I have a mug from that museum that has, I believe I was there at, there was an exhibition of Mayan and Aztec masks, and I fucking loved it, and I just hope I get a few hours in that museum. And the dinosaur bones, lads. Christ. Although dinosaurs have been ruined for me recently, you know. I mean, I was first properly confronted with a decent set of dinosaur bones in the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. They had a fucking T-Rex and a Velociraptor. And I was just marvelling at their majesty, you know. I had a mad horn for dinosaurs when I was younger. Like, even before Jurassic Park. How's that for hipsterism? But, like, being beside these T-Rexes and Velociraptors and Brachiosauruses and imagining them as these ferocious lizards. But, unfortunately, in the past 10 years, you know, science has learned a lot more about dinosaurs. And most of them, they were most likely feathered and honked instead of roared, you know. And I can't take a Velociraptor seriously if I just imagine them as this annoying, honking, feathered bird that can't fly. So hopefully that new scientific revelation won't sully my experience in the Royal Ontario Museum. What else do I like to do? I enjoy Jewish delicatessens, and there's a Jewish delicatessen called Kaplinsky's in Toronto. If I can visit there, I will as well. Hopefully my schedule won't be fucking mad and I won't be just on the road all the time. And of course, fucking hash is legal there as well. And it's a hash company's bringing us there. So I hope I don't, like, I don't know, end up in the museum looking at the dinosaurs pulling up a whitener. Imagining the dinosaurs honking. So that's something that I'm going to try and not do as well. Look at that now. Social anxiety creeping in. I'm supposed to be going over to Toronto to enjoy myself. And I've already fantasized into reality the inevitability of me pulling a whitener in front of a lot of dinosaur bones and being asked to leave the country. Fuck that. Yeah, but there's going to be a wider world tour in the works. Probably some American dates. Most likely a bit of Australia. I'll be going to Australia when it's our winter and their summer. That's not confirmed now, but I'm trying to work it out, I'm trying to make it happen. And then what I can't wait to do is to start doing some live podcasts in the non-English speaking countries, because, like, in fucking Spain, like, you know what I mean, fairly decent listenership, several thousand people listening to this in Spain. There's listeners all over the gaff, and I get contact from some of the people listening in these countries, and the vibe that I get is people who speak English as a second language and who really, really want to speak it well tend to listen to a lot of podcasts. They tend to listen to English that's spoken in regional accents or English that's hard to understand as a way to challenge themselves. So most of my like Brazilian or fucking Argentinian or Italian, Spanish listeners, that's what they're doing. It's like they said, I listened to your podcast because I wanted to hear, see if I could listen to somebody speaking English in an Irish accent, and they end up then staying for the content. So it's quite a bizarre thing that I never thought would happen. So before I move on, I'm just going to really, really quickly plug Irish Life Podcasts in April. I know it's annoying, but I'm under contractual obligation to promote them, so I'm going to do it mad quickly, okay? This Saturday, Monaghan, Castle Blaney, sold out. Thank you, Monaghan. Friday, 5th of April, Naas, Moat Theatre. 6th of April, Vicar Street, Dublin. 7th of April, Vicar Street, Dublin. Still a few tickets left for those. Friday the 12th of April, Whitla Hall, Belfast. Few tickets left there. 27th of April, Cork in the Opera House. All those gigs are almost sold out, but there's tickets left. So thank you very much and God bless. Last week, what was I fucking doing last week? Last week I was filming in Limerick. I brought over, as you know, I have a BBC series which is called Blind by Undestroys, and I think that's a, it might be a working title, not sure, but the pilot was called Blind by Undestroys Housing, and for each episode we're going to take a new theme. So I'm working on that series. As you know, I was over in London filming it. So this week, the last bits we needed to film, I said, fuck off, ye come to Limerick, I'm too busy, I'm writing a fucking book, I'm doing this podcast, I'm doing new Bandits tunes at the weekend, I don't want to go to London, ye come to me. So the BBC came over to me to Limerick, and we did some filming, and we'd great crack, and it's just nice to film in Limerick, and what was sound was the amount of help we got from just local businesses. Like, I want to give two shout outs, because the thing is, you can't shout out businesses on the BBC, because the BBC is 100% paid by British taxpayer money, so they don't do any advertising. Also, yes, I got British taxpayer money, brought it to fucking Limerick, and got to create a couple of jobs. Temporary jobs just for a week, but nonetheless created some employment in Ireland with British money. So take that, Maggie Thatcher. Dolan's Warehouse in Limerick were unbelievably sound. They gave us the full upstairs to film for an entire day. Unbelievably helpful. So God bless ye and fair play. And what else? The Art College in Limerick, LSAD, where I did my degree and I did my master's. I went to the film and lens based media course there and said to them, how are you getting on, lads? I'm in Limerick with a BBC film crew, a proper professional film crew. Would you like to send a couple of students so that they can watch? So that happened too. A few students came down from the film and lens based media course in LSAD, and they got to see a proper film set in action with professional equipment and got to observe and watch. Not free labour, lads. They got to observe and watch. And yeah, I do that because I have undying love for the Art College in Limerick, because I fucking hated school. I really, really didn't like school. I didn't suit at the academic secondary school education system at all. I was consistently in trouble. The only enjoyment I got out of school was messing and creating trouble. That's what I used to enjoy. I used to enjoy being a smart arse and making people laugh. I did not enjoy academic work. It didn't click with me. I didn't like this business of just learning things for the sake of it. I cannot do maths at all. I can barely count my fingers. I literally can't do maths. So I ended up doing foundation for the fucking Leaving Cert, which means you effectively fail your Leaving Cert then. But when I went to Limerick School of Art and Design when I was about 18, it was the first time ever that teachers, I suppose, had told me I was good at something. And it was the first time that I felt worthy. It felt like I had something proper to offer, because I'd spent the whole time in secondary school being called a bowsy and being told I was useless. So when I got to art college, I'd be there painting and drawing, and all of a sudden, like, the teacher, who I'm scared of because secondary school had taught me to be afraid of teachers, all of a sudden the lecturers are going, "Wow, you're brilliant, well done." And that alone at a young age was fucking huge. For at that moment I was like, alright, okay, I can be a professional artist. Do you know, I can take, and I'm not painting and drawing now, but it doesn't matter what I'm doing with music or with the podcast or writing books, that's all art. That's all, it all comes from a kind of a stem of creativity, and the art college was very important for me in developing those skills. So I did like to knock on their door and try and be sound to them and say, "Do you want to give me a couple of students and they can see what's happening for experience?" So this week's podcast is going to be about, it's going to be musical, it's going to be a music, some a roasting hot take, and a bit of musical history and reflection. Now, I know last week I briefly covered Enya, but looking back, that wasn't really a hot take. That was me making the case for why Enya deserves more critical acclaim, and I got a lot of positive responses to that. People agreed with me. And then we had an interview with Michelle Darmody and Ellie Kiziumbe about Direct Provision. Got a great response to that too. It's great just to be able to put stories like that out there and get people listening and talking and thinking about Direct Provision. So this week, yeah, musical hot take. And it is about, it's my own, something I've been baiting around in my head for a while, something I've been kind of fixating on. It's my own kind of theory on the origins of the sound of the band Nirvana, right? Specifically Kurt Cobain's voice and Kurt Cobain's tone, and where that kind of comes from. Now, I have an utterly fucking bizarre hot take around it. Now, when I say hot take, what I mean is, because you don't take my fucking podcast literally. There's a lot of people taking my podcast literally. I'm not an expert on anything. Okay, so if I'm talking about history, if I'm talking about music, it's mostly fairly informed opinion. Do you know? Sometimes I get things wrong. Sometimes I have a few details that are off. But my main motivation with this podcast, even when I'm talking about history or, you know, stuff that's happened, my motivation essentially is entertainment. I want to completely and utterly entertain you. I want to give the most entertaining version of events rather than the one that's, I won't say historically inaccurate, because I never knowingly talk out of my hole. I won't knowingly lie to you. If I don't know a piece of information, I'll let you know that I don't know about it. But at the same time, I'm liable to make the odd mistake, because I'm not a fucking expert. I'm not an expert in anything. So be careful around that, because I get people talking shit about me online. I get people saying, talking about how I might be inaccurate in my history or things like that. So don't go around saying that I'm an authority. I'm not. I'm someone who's talking into a sock in their bedroom, who's somewhat informed, but ultimately what I'm trying to do is provide entertainment and something that's interesting and nice to listen to and a bit of crack. And, So yeah, don't want to get on to exactly what the hot take is yet, but obviously I love Nirvana. I fucking adore Nirvana. They're, how could you not? They're the last great, huge superstar band, you know, in that tradition of massive bands. It kind of stops at Nirvana. You can make a case for Radiohead, but really Nirvana are the last in that line of Beatles, Led Zeppelin, Prince, you know, this huge behemoth act that transcend time and will forever exist. I just don't hear Radiohead. I love Radiohead, but I don't hear them getting the Generation Z and young millennials. You don't really hear them listening to that much fucking Radiohead, but Nirvana has survived. Kurt Cobain is a legend. Nirvana's music is listened to. The music is classic. It's going nowhere. It's amazing. And ultimately with Nirvana, I think what separates, like, Nirvana came out of the Seattle grunge scene in the early, late 80s. And what kind of grunge is like, okay, you're talking Seattle and the state of Washington that's up in the top left of America, but it comes from, we'll say, the heaviness of 80s metal, right? So the heaviness and aggressiveness of metal, but without the technical prowess of metal. So 80s metal, thrash, we'll say, Megadeth, Metallica, very, very heavy, loud music with massive amounts of distortion, but also quite technical, like Van Halen, virtuoso musicians. Grunge kind of took that heaviness and that loudness, but then mixed it with the DIY sensibility of punk. Punk music isn't about technical prowess. Punk music is about simplicity and the idea that anyone can pick up a guitar and start a band. So the two of them kind of mixed together in the most simplistic way is a very simple definition of what grunge music was. And Nirvana came out of the grunge scene. There were many, many bands in Seattle who were making grunge music. The closest to Nirvana's sound would be the Melvins. You know, you go and listen to a couple of Melvins albums and it sounds like Nirvana. But, you know, out of all these grunge bands, who else did you have? Fucking Alice in Chains. Well, they were kind of big. No, fuck it, let's go with the big ones. Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains, Mudhoney, the Melvins, as I mentioned. All these bands, and they were class, but they haven't really survived in the way that Nirvana has. You're going to get the odd few people listening to Pearl Jam, but in terms of legacy, I mean, 1990 was 29 fucking years ago. So nearly 30 years ago. Am I wrong with that? I can't do maths, lads. How long ago was 1990? Was it 20 years? Oh man, I'm shit at maths. Let's just say 1990 was 20 years ago. No, it's 30 years. 29 years ago. Right? So grunge was like 30 years ago, we'll say. Nirvana really are the only ones that have survived properly. Okay? You're still going to get a few heads into Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam, but Nirvana have survived. The reason is what separated Nirvana from all of the other grunge acts is that, yes, Nirvana were heavy as fuck and hard as fuck, right? But ultimately, Nirvana, the music is a postmodern, ironic throwback to 60s pop music. If you got Beatles songs and kind of put really heavy, loud guitars over them, you'd be in the territory of Nirvana. Kurt Cobain liked 1960s bubblegum pop, right? And this comes through in the melodies that are in Nirvana's music. So, you know, Pearl Jam is really dark. The Melvins were dark as fuck, really loud and heavy, but not a lot of melody going on. Nirvana, ultimately, they're very, very catchy songs. Like, there's a thing in songwriting called the Old Grey Whistle Test, okay? Now, not the TV show called the Old Grey Whistle Test. The TV show was named after this phenomenon whereby in the early 20th century in New York, there was a place called Tin Pan Alley. And in Tin Pan Alley, around a thing called the Brill Building, I believe, loads of songwriters used to have pianos and they would write songs mainly for the sheet music industry. Not even records yet. Writing catchy songs for people to buy as sheet music and go home and play at home or sing in a pub. So it was called Tin Pan Alley because you had all these songwriters on pianos playing at the same time in the same area. So this cacophony of different pianos sounded like people banging pots and pans. So in Tin Pan Alley, when they were trying to write songs and they needed to figure out what was going to be a hit, okay, what they would do is a thing called the Old Grey Whistle Test. So the songwriter would write a song on piano with piano and their voice. They'd really, really quickly cut it to vinyl, right? Really quickly, just one press copy to vinyl. And then what would happen in the evening when they all went home, cleaning ladies would come in. And they referred to these cleaning ladies as the Old Greys, okay? So the lads would have the song that they'd written that day on the vinyl, leave it on the player on loop all night. And if they came in the next day and the Old Greys, the women, were whistling the song that they had left on repeat, it meant it had passed the Old Grey Whistle Test and that song was going to be a hit. Nirvana's music passes the Old Grey Whistle Test. It's still to this day that is a, you know, if, for me, I always knew if we were recording a music video, and obviously when you're recording a music video, you have to play the song over and over on set. If the extras in the video very quickly start whistling the melody of the song for the video, you know you've got a hit in your hands. When we were recording Horse Outside, within 20 minutes, every single person who was an extra in that video couldn't stop whistling and singing the tune. So I then, thinking Old Grey Whistle Test, in my head was going, fuck it, that song's going to do all right. So Nirvana passes Old Grey Whistle Test, not a bother. You hear a Nirvana song, it's stuck in your head all day. No matter how heavy it is, no matter how hard it is, Kurt Cobain had the melodic sensibilities of 60s pop. He has publicly said that, you know, he was a huge fan of the Beatles when he was a kid. But the kind of the holy trinity of 60s guitar pop for me, okay, would be the Beatles, the Kinks, and the Beach Boys, okay? I think the biggest influence on Nirvana is, without question, the Beach Boys. It's fucking uncanny. I'll show you quickly, like, because when I say that to people, when I say to people, Nirvana are just a really heavy Beach Boys, people go, shut up, you're talking out of your hole. And maybe I am talking out of my hole. But I'm going to play you a quick example now, we'll say, of a Nirvana song, and then I'll follow it up with a little Beach Boys song, just a clip. Now, my hot take isn't Nirvana were influenced by the Beach Boys. It's one aspect of the hot take. I'm sure there's someone else out there saying that Nirvana and the Beach Boys were similar. My hot take is way worse than that. I'm going to get to it in a while. But here is a snippet of a Nirvana song called About a Girl. So that's Nirvana, About a Girl, about, that would have been written 89, 1990, right? So now I'm going to play ye 1965, The Beach Boys, and listen to the similarities between the two tracks so you don't think I'm mad. This song is called Girl Don't Tell Me.
Hi little girl, it's me, don't you know who I am? met you last summer when I came up to stay with my friend. I'm the guy who left you with tears in his eyes. You didn't answer my letter, so I figured it was just a lie. Your hair is getting long and your shorts, they sure fit fine.
So that's the Beach Boys, Girl Don't Tell Me. And, you know, you'd want to be deaf to not see that there's massive similarities between those two songs. That fucking Beach, 65, that's nearly 30 years ago, you know? Or sorry, 60 years ago. So, and the Nirvana song was written 30 years after that. So those are two songs that are 30 years apart, yet they sound quite similar. Because Kurt Cobain, he got his singing style from the Beach Boys. And what makes the Beach Boys kind of stand out, now when we think of the Beach Boys, when I say to people the Beach Boys, people who aren't, we'd say, huge music fans, the Beach Boys have an image of kind of being novelty and fun. And you will hear serious music heads, people who really care about music, will give the Beach Boys the respect they deserve. But the average person who's not crazy about music wouldn't put the Beach Boys on a Beatles level, we'll say. But they absolutely fucking are. Like, first off, Brian Wilson is as important a producer as Phil Spector. The Beach Boys album Pet Sounds is one of the most important albums of the 20th century and what it did for production. But what makes the Beach Boys unique is that you had fucking Brian Wilson and the other fella, Mike Love, with these incredibly sweet melodic falsettos. But then you also had Dennis Wilson, the drummer, and Carl Wilson, who had Dennis and Carl had shit voices, okay? By the standards of 1960s music and what was considered normal and what was considered a good voice, Carl Wilson and Dennis Wilson both had awful, husky voices that were in a low kind of range. And what you hear with that song there, Girl Don't Tell Me, and what separates it from the rest of the Beach Boys' work, the lead singer doesn't have a strong voice that can go, the melodies aren't reaching high. Instead, what they do is they reach low. So where, if Brian Wilson was singing that song, those melodies would be falsetto and they'd reach high and they'd be catchy. But because it was either Dennis or Carl with their shit voices singing that song, when the melody was supposed to go high where they were singing, they dragged it down. And what you end up is that right there. I speak a lot about, you know, music is an ongoing conversation, okay? It's an ongoing conversation whereby you can trace the DNA of music and songs. And what I like to obsess over is to trace DNA of songs and go, I like this song, where did it come from? And where did the song that it came from come from? But every so often, you have your little genetic mutations. And the genetic mutations are happy accidents that change the genetic code as such. They change the, it's like, you know, a traditional musical conversation is two songs having a conversation with each other over time, and then just this lunatic comes in and spits in someone's face, and that stops the conversation, and then a new one has to start about why someone had their face spat into. Do you know what I mean? That might be a very extreme example, but that there is a genetic mutation in music. Either Carl or Dennis Wilson with their terrible voices in that song in 1965, and I'm guessing, like, they're all a family, you see, you know, and their dad used to manage them. Their dad was a prick. Their dad beat the fuck out of Brian Wilson and made him deaf in one ear. Brian Wilson had terrible mental health problems, but because they're a family, they were quite democratic with the songs and the music. So they used to kind of cringe when Carl Wilson or Dennis Wilson was singing because they had shit voices. So that song there is an album track. You know, I don't think it ranked much as a single. but it's a genetic mutation in that right there is the, that's the DNA of Nirvana. That is the start of the Nirvana conversation in that song. Because in Kurt Cobain's track About a Girl and all of Nirvana's repertoire, Kurt Cobain doesn't have a particularly good voice either, to be honest. Now, good isn't the right word. Kurt Cobain doesn't have a traditionally strong singer's voice. He has a mid-range, husky voice. You know, he smoked a lot of fags. He was a heroin addict. His throat wasn't great. So it was a gravelly, husky voice, whereby if Kurt Cobain was given the choice of, you know, singing a high melody like Paul McCartney could do or John Lennon could do, he wouldn't go for the high melody. He'd drag the melody down. And if he had to go high, he might scream instead. Such was the weakness of his voice. Carl and Dennis Wilson had the same thing. So back to the Beach Boys song. What you get with that Beach Boys song now, listening to it since grunge has happened, it has that... Nirvana's music, like I said, it was a postmodern response to 60s bubblegum pop. So if you listen to early Beatles music, like I Want to Hold Your Hand, the really catchy, shiny Beatlemania before 1965 Beatles music, it's very upbeat, it's very catchy, and you can't get it out of your head. It operates on a nursery rhyme level. Then, of course, after 65, they start getting a bit dark. Same with the Kinks. Kinks before 65, really catchy. Not a lot of staying on major chords to keep it really nursery rhyme type of catchy, you know? Also, what you get is sincerity. Early Beach Boys stuff, early Beatles stuff, it's sincere. When they're singing about I want to hold your hand, they mean I want to hold your fucking hand. Sincerity is a modernist principle. The postmodern response to sincerity is irony and humour and angst. That's what you get with Nirvana. Nirvana is not sincere. You know, here we are now, entertain us, but sang like someone who's... does not want to be entertained, someone who's tired. That's irony. If the Beatles were singing it, they'd be quite happily saying, entertain us, quite happily. Also regarding the Beach Boys song, the reason I believe it to be an accidental genetic mutation is because they weren't thinking about irony in 1965. Irony was not present in popular music in 1965. It was sincerity. And I know this with that song because there's an instrument in there called a glockenspiel. A glockenspiel is like a tinkly sound. It sounds a bit like a triangle, but it's on what's known as an arpeggio, which is a repeating loop. I know from listening to that they were echoing back to a Buddy Holly song called Every Day, which is a really simple, sincere bubblegum pop song. I know by the production that's what they were echoing. They were trying to continue that conversation, but then Carl or Dennis walks into the room with their terrible voices and ends up accidentally subverting the sincerity of what Brian Wilson's intention would be when he wrote the song. That's that fucking Beach Boys song, it starts to feel a bit depressing, but not bad depressing, good depressing. Angst. There's angst and pain when either Dennis or Carl drag those notes down. You hear pain in their voice, you don't hear enthusiasm. You hear an ironic angst, and that's what Nirvana's music is. To kind of lay foundation to that argument, just look at Nirvana's music videos from the early 90s. Look at a video like In Bloom. In the video for In Bloom, it's a deliberate parody of the Beatles' first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show in like 1963. The Ed Sullivan Show would have been like the Late Late Show in America. It was... if an act was to break America, they went on the Ed Sullivan Show and they performed and that was it. They became massive. The Rolling Stones were on it as well. So when the Beatles first went on the Ed Sullivan Show, they could barely perform because all the girls in the audience were screaming and roaring. And I think they did I Want to Hold Your Hand. So in Nirvana's video for In Bloom, which is 1991, they do it in black and white. They dress up looking like the Beatles or Buddy Holly, but they play this crazy fucking heavy, depressing song where instead of the melodies going up, the melodies of the vocal goes down. So right there you can tell that that's an early 90s postmodern ironic remix of and using things like nostalgia as well, because the Beatles would have been and the Beach Boys would have been what Kurt Cobain and the rest of Nirvana were listening to when they were kids. Nirvana is an ironic response to 60s pop. But the roots of it, I think, is the vocals of Carl and Dennis Wilson. And I think it's a strong enough case. You can't deny that. You can't listen to those two songs beside each other and tell me, holy fuck, that Nirvana track sounds a lot like that Beach Boys track. I've played that Beach Boys track for people for the laugh and said to them, did you hear this Nirvana song? And a few people take a few seconds to go, that's not Nirvana. Do you know what I mean? It's the same thing. It's a depressed vocal that goes down when it should go up. And what this does is it creates a feeling of angst and coolness and irony, which didn't really belong in 60s music. It's a late postmodern thing that belonged in 80s and 90s. The Pixies kind of introduced it as well. So that's not even my hot take. That's not even my hot take. That's the foundations for the hot take to give me a sense of authority. Just to expand a little bit as well on, to try and make the concept of irony in music simple, because I'm just reminding myself, I'm someone who like makes fucking art for a living, and the concept to me might be easy because it's the world I live in. But if you're an accountant, we'll say, you'd be like, what the fuck is he on about? What's irony? A simple example of irony would be, it's when you have two opposing things, right? Two things that oppose, that have two separate meanings, and when you mix them together in just the right way, it creates this new meaning. That new meaning is irony. Classic example of, we'll say, early 90s angsty irony that Nirvana would have been operating in. The film Reservoir Dogs. The most famous scene in Reservoir Dogs is where your man is in a warehouse, the policeman is in a warehouse tied up in a chair, and the gangster cuts his ear off. Alright, we all know that from Reservoir Dogs, okay? What made that particular scene so groundbreaking in 1991, which is the same year that Nirvana are doing their shit, because this is real fucking Generation X irony carry on. So, irony assumes that, and postmodernism assumes that the audience who is watching, who is consuming the thing that they're watching, is literate in media, that they've grown up around television, they've grown up around films. So Tarantino knows, when he has the Reservoir Dogs scene cutting off your man's ear, he knows that his audience have seen violent films before, that they've grown up with them. So when the razor blade comes out and you know some violence is going to happen, the Tarantino knows that the audience expect scary music. Classic example, 1960s, the film Psycho, right? The film Psycho, your one is in the shower and your man comes in with the knife, and you have that really striking, scary violin music that we all know, the scary music in Psycho. That set a precedent. That's like, that's sincere. That's a sincerity. Woman is being killed in the shower, the music is scary. It all matches up, it makes sense. That's sincerity. Now we've got 1991 Reservoir Dogs. There's a man tied up in a chair. He has petrol thrown on him and he's going to get his ear cut off. What does Tarantino do? He plays 70s bubblegum pop. He plays a piece of music which is happy and upbeat. And this piece of information, this happy and upbeat music, juxtaposed with a person getting their ear cut off. The mixture of those two opposing meanings blended perfectly together creates this new emotion called irony. That's what irony is. And that's what Nirvana's music is. Sincere, early 60s bubblegum pop, but done with very, very heavy guitars. And instead of going for the upbeat melody, you go down on the melody and you have now this irony. So Nirvana's music really is, it's the ear getting cut off scene in Reservoir Dogs. And you know, why do we have irony in the early 60s and why do we not have irony in, you know, why do we have sincerity in the early 60s and then irony in the early 90s? My personal opinion, I think you look at what's happening from 1960 to 1965, you've got the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. The world truly, genuinely believed that it was going to end in nuclear war. In 1963, people thought the world was going to end. Okay? The Cuban Missile Crisis was no fucking joke. Russia and America came very close to destroying the entire world with nuclear missiles. That's a reality. So therefore, culture must reflect that terror and fear by feeding people good news. The early music of the Beatles and the early music of the Beach Boys pre-65 is a load of good news. Then, mid-60s onwards, shit changes a bit. Irony starts to get introduced when the Beatles start doing acid with Sgt. Pepper. And the ultimate act of irony in pop music in the 60s, the final defining ironic act, 1969, Woodstock Festival. This is 69, you've got the Vietnam War going on, but the Vietnam War is dragging its heels. As well, what makes the Vietnam War so special compared to World War II, it's the first war that people are seeing on television and are actually being confronted with the meaninglessness, the angst, and the hopelessness of what war really is. With World War II, you can control it with propaganda. You can say to people, our troops are fighting the good fight and they're all coming home and they died on the battlefield in a noble way. By the time Vietnam comes, by 69, people are seeing on the news about things like the My Lai massacre. They're seeing US soldiers committing war crimes. They're seeing villages on fire. They're seeing children with their backs on fire. So this now, you can no longer believe in the sincerity of good war. So by 1969, this is reflected in art, perfectly, ironically. Jimi Hendrix, at the Woodstock Festival, does a guitar solo. He does the Star Spangled Banner, which is the American national anthem. He plays it on an electric guitar and distorts and fucks up the notes to make this proud song of a nation sound very fucked up and painful. And right, that for me is the touchstone of the introduction of irony to pop music, that Jimi Hendrix moment, 1969. I've digressed. I've fucking digressed, lads. All right, very, very quick ocarina pause, or no, banjo pause before I move on to the final hot take. The banjo's on the other side of the room and I'm not going to go over to get it. I've got this really big, giant, depressing ocarina. So we'll have an awful ocarina pause. Fuck that.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I can't even get a couple of notes out of it, like... Enough of that. So that was the shit ocarina pause. You might have heard an advert for some bullshit. This podcast is sponsored by you, the listener, via the Patreon page, patreon.com/theblindbuypodcast. Do you like the podcast? Do you find it enjoyable? Well, you can become a patron by giving me the price of a cup of coffee or the price of a pint once a month via the Patreon. patreon.com/theblindbuypodcast. Please do. Please, please do. If you can afford it. It makes a huge difference to my life. If you can't afford it, that's grand. Yurt. Okay. I launched into a... Do you know what? That was a necessary explanation of irony and how it relates to culture. And it kind of tied in with the theme because it stuck it with 60s music. So, my warm take is that Nirvana and Kurt Cobain's voice in particular can trace their origins to the Beach Boys, in particular the song Girl Don't Tell Me, 1965. That is my belief. Where does it get hotter? Well, this is the moment where, like, let's just say you and me are in a pub and we've just sat down, we've had a pint, you know, and I've spoken all about, I'm making my case for the Beach Boys and Nirvana, and you're listening to me and you're going, fuck it, Blind Boy, yeah, do you know what? I'm on board, I like it. Now I'm going to start going somewhere where you're going to slowly just back away. You're just going to get your pint and you're going to leave. Alright? Which is, that's where I want to be with a good hot take. That's really where I want to be. I want people to be just going, fuck off. Okay? So, Dennis Wilson. Okay? So, that song that I played you, Dennis and Carl Wilson with their terrible, terrible voices, which I believe inspired Kurt Cobain. Specifically, I think the biggest inspiration on Kurt Cobain's voice was Dennis Wilson, okay? This is where it starts getting mad. Dennis Wilson, he was a bit of a, I don't want to say, waster isn't fair, because he had his issues, right? He had his issues. He had mental health issues, he had issues with addiction, all of this. He was just the drummer in the band. He was Brian Wilson's brother. You know, they're not going to kick their brother out of the band. He was the drummer in the band. He didn't even drum that much on the albums. They would bring in a better drummer to do it. But Dennis was still, like, earning a fair amount of cash. So, and he liked to spend his cash. And he appears to be, like, a very sensitive person. A kind of a kind person. But as well, also, you know, someone who's very easily hurt and lashes out, a person with problems. Dennis Wilson in 1968 was driving around. He had a big fucking mansion up in Malibu, I believe, and he was driving around and he met a hitchhiker, okay? And the hitchhiker had three or four girls with him. So Dennis stops anyway in his kind of his innocence and good nature and gets chatting with the hitchhiker. He likes the vibe of the hitchhiker. He seems like a cool dude. The girls seem class. So Dennis says to the hitchhiker, get into my car there, so, and we'll head back to my fucking mansion and I'll look after you. So he does. So the man and five women, I believe, head back to Dennis Wilson's gaff and end up staying with him for about 6 months. And, like, they end up, like, having, like, mad sex orgies and doing acid. I think they all caught gonorrhea. Dennis was just, like, looking after them. The Beach Boys didn't give that much of a fuck, really, because Dennis wasn't needed in studio. So the main hitchhiker, the man, starts, like, showing Dennis Wilson his songs and telling Dennis Wilson all about, you know, his plan. This hitchhiker's name was Charles Manson. Charles the lunatic, mass murdering, psychopath, serial killer Manson. Dennis Wilson became friends with Charles fucking Manson and wrote songs with him. Right? Now, Charles Manson, like, you know Charles Manson. He died last year, I believe, but he is, you know, like the archetype for crazy serial killer. He had the Nazi tattoo. He's a swastika in the middle of his fucking forehead. You know, we've all grown up seeing Charles Manson. He's become a media spectacle, quite unhealthily. One of these serial killers that was given superstar status. But before Charles Manson, and what Charles Manson did is he used his influence to form a small cult of about 8 people, mostly women, and they lured people to a gaff and murdered them. They murdered several people. Very evil, fucked up shit. And what's important to remember is that before Manson did this, and this harks back to what I said a couple of podcasts ago about why it's important not to dehumanize psychopaths and pedophiles and abusers, Manson obviously would have had a huge degree of superficial charm. And it was this charm and magnetism and charisma that got him close to someone like Dennis Wilson. And it was this charisma that allowed him to have a cult, you know. A cult sounds like fucking hard work, lads. If you're going to have a cult, a bunch of cunts who follow you around and do what you tell them, you better be charismatic and convincing. And Charles Manson was this. Before the murders, he was also an aspiring singer-songwriter. He was obsessed with the interpreting the music, the lyrics of the Beatles. In particular, and this is what I find quite interesting too, the song, the Beatles song Helter Skelter, which is a Paul McCartney song, which is, some people will cite it as the first ever heavy metal song. Some people, there's lots of candidates for what's the first heavy metal song, but the bog standard, we'll say Rolling Stone article, reading is that Helter Skelter is the first ever metal song. But Manson believed that Helter Skelter referred to a world event whereby America would have a race war, and Manson committed a series of murders in order to trigger this race war that would, like, bring an apocalypse or something. I don't know, mad bullshit. So Dennis Wilson, big fucking agent, becomes best pals with Charles Manson, starts writing songs with him, starts bringing these songs to the Beach Boys, right? But then what happens? Because Charles Manson's a fucking lunatic. So himself and Charles start writing songs, and then I think they went to a studio one day, and Dennis Wilson's, like, management were there or something anyway, and there was a disagreement. And because Charles Manson's a psychopath, he pulled a knife. He pulled a knife on bodyguards or security or something. Anyway, himself and Dennis Wilson ended up in a scuffle, in a bit of a fight. Okay? Now, this is where it's hazy. This is the bit where I don't have full historical accuracy on this bit. What we do know is that Dennis Wilson got into a scrap with Charles Manson, right? We do know this. What we also know, Dennis Wilson got punched into the throat at some point after 1968, and this crushed his larynx, I believe, and permanently changed his voice. Now, I think Charles Manson boxed Dennis Wilson into the throat and fucked his voice up. Okay? That's what I think. I don't have the evidence for that. I know there was a scrap, and I know that Dennis Wilson ended up with a boxed larynx. What I can't prove is that Charles Manson did it. But my hot take brain wants to say Charles Manson boxed Dennis Wilson into the throat and permanently changed his voice. The greatest influence on Kurt Cobain's vocal style was the solo work that Dennis Wilson did after getting a box into the throat. That's when Dennis's voice went really low and really husky, and you start to hear the origins of that grungy sound, the origins of a person who has a raspy, damaged voice singing over melodic voices and keeping all the notes low. So my hot take, ladies and gentlemen, is that Kurt Cobain sounds the way he does because Charles Manson boxed Dennis Wilson into the throat. Okay? Can't prove it. It's just, that's my theory. That's my theory, and that's what I take to bed at night and hold dearly as a little fun nugget that I keep to myself. You can call me a fool if you want. That's grand. What are we up to here? What time are we? We're at the hour mark. So Dennis Wilson died. He died at about 1983. Didn't have a very happy life at all. Ended up, like, marrying a fucking 19-year-old or something stupid like that. Severe cocaine problems with alcohol, other addiction issues. Not a very happy person. You know, obviously he got the fuck away from Charles Manson. The guilt of it stuck with him. It kind of traumatized him a bit. It's like, I had this man living in my house for like 2 months, 3 months. He was friends of mine. And then he went and became the most famous and notorious serial killer in America. And Manson's legacy, you know, Marilyn Manson is named after him. Do you know? Manson has a strange musical rock star legacy. The one that I think is that he boxed Dennis Wilson into the throat, and that Dennis Wilson voice after 1968 influenced Kurt Cobain. So what I'll leave you with before I head away, I'll play, like, Dennis Wilson did not have a successful solo career. He made one album called Pacific Ocean Blue. It's only now, in the past 10 years, being looked at as a kind of an important album, as something that was a precursor to, like, when it came out, it's like, Dennis, you can't, your fucking throat is boxed off. You couldn't sing for the first time round, and now you're after getting a box into the throat, and you definitely can't sing now. So it really wouldn't have sold anything. It would have been ripped to shreds. He would have been seen as a god help us. But Dennis Wilson was a genetic accident that laid the foundations for angsty 90s grunge and alternative rock. You know, not just grunge, like bands like Pavement and stuff like that. You can hear that in Dennis Wilson's voice. Now, obviously, Neil Young, that's a whole other conversation. That's a different conversation about his contribution to grunge. But Dennis Wilson is part of the conversation, without a doubt. So I'll play you a song now. There's about three or four versions of it. It's either sometimes called Lady. It's sometimes called Fallen in Love. It's one of my favourite tunes. I heard this about 10 years ago. No, longer. I heard this longer ago. It's from 1970, I believe. And it's a very, very upset, sad Dennis Wilson, whose voice is fucked, just trying his best. And what it reminds me of a lot of as well is there's a Nirvana song called Something in the Way. And if you know Something in the Way, it's on Nevermind. What makes Something in the Way so special is that Kurt Cobain's voice really sounds like shit in that song, but the shitness of it is pure beauty, because Kurt Cobain was lying on his back, and as he was lying on his back, like, his neck was kind of pushing down, pushing towards, like, try singing lying on your back, it's not very easy. So he was lying on his back with the guitar, and he recorded Something in the Way, and the producer, I'm gonna say it was Butch Vig, the producer heard Kurt Cobain on lying down on the couch singing Something in the Way and said, don't fucking move, I'm putting a mic beside you. The way you are singing on your back like that, that's perfect. So they recorded it, and it was out of tune, and they tuned down the violins and everything to fit Kurt's shit voice. But I hear Dennis Wilson, 1970, Fallen in Love, in that Kurt Cobain take, and that's what I'm going to play for you now. I'll play 30, 40 seconds. I'd love to play the whole fucking thing. I can't because of the nature of the podcast and shit getting taken down. So this is Fallen in Love by Dennis Wilson. It's utterly beautiful. It's unintentionally sad and angsty because of poor old Dennis and his broken throat. And what makes it even a little bit more sad for me too is that he's a drummer and there's not even drums on it. We've spoken about drum machines before. There's a drum machine on this song. Using a drum machine in 1970 was not being cool. It was a really shit novelty thing to do, and it was someone who couldn't afford a drummer or couldn't afford to record drums. This would have been viewed on as, it would have been seen as a pile of shit when it came out.
Flowers come in the spring, all the love I can bring, bring it for my lady. All I can do, you know it's for my lady. I love her so, I love to grow with my lady. Falling in love, summer winds again together with the lady. Love the life I live the life that.
So there you go, Dennis Wilson, early 70s, lady slash fallen in love. That is not a pile of shit, that's a fucking beautiful, gorgeous, bloody song. It's years and years and years ahead of its time. Unintentionally, most likely, but I fucking love it. I fucking love it, and I'd say Kurt Cobain loved it as well. And I can hear Nirvana's sound in that song and in the earlier Dennis Wilson shit with the Beach Boys. That's my hot take. Think Charlie Manson was responsible. There you go. Okay, I'm gonna fuck off now. Thank you so much for listening. I really enjoyed this. I love any podcast where I get to speak with passion about music and about things that I obsess about and think about a lot. I love doing. And I really, really enjoyed that. And I hope you enjoyed it too, and that my passion was infectious. Not sure what I'm going to talk about next week. Should we figure something out? In the meantime, enjoy the stretch in the evening. Be compassionate towards yourself. Be compassionate towards your neighbour. Have a lovely time. Listen to some Nirvana. If you're the type of person who's has never really considered the music of the Beach Boys, give it a crack. In particular, the stereo version of Pet Sounds. Fuck me, you can't go wrong with that, you know? Alright, God bless, Yurt.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.